This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The ability to share these photos with you means a lot to me, especially because, as I was mentioning to some people early on this evening, the originals of these photos no longer exist. If there had not been an opportunity for me to digitize these photos and be able to reprint them in the way that you are now experiencing them as a part of this exhibit, they'd be lost to eternity. And so the conversations that we've planned throughout the exhibit, these Q&A sessions with people that I consider to be seminal figures in archiving history that I've been blessed to be a part of and consider valuable, reinforces the notion that these are moments in history that people have purposefully captured. My uncle, as both the first black White House news photographer and as a member of the Johnson Publications staff, had access to these moments in history, to conversations and closeness with the subjects of these images that probably cannot be replicated in the era that we live in now, because people are either wide open during a 24-hour news cycle and trying to give you access to information that you may not have ever wanted, or they're deeply, deeply private because of the expectation of access that comes in the era in which we live now. And so I value the idea that my uncle, through sheer perseverance, because he was turned away from the notion of being a professional photographer at nearly every turn of his career. He tried to do it with the Pentagon, and they said, nope, skin's a little too dark for that. Why are you even considering this? Find something else that you're interested in. So he was a self-made man. He didn't study photography in any formal capacity. He had a camera, he had an eye, and he found creative ways to have access before he was officially credentialed to do so. And in that space of probably adding, when he was finally added to the White House news photographer pool, and his years at Johnson Publication was nearly 40 years behind the lens, serving up our history in such a beautiful, beautiful way. So just being able to show you all some of the outtakes that come from my aunt's personal collection. So these were, you know, photos that may not have ever made their way into an official Ebony or Jet magazine, but that my uncle was proud of. And so he gave copies of these photos to my aunt just to say, look what I did. And now I happen to be the caretaker of these images for at least another generation or so. And so you're welcomed into the salon, as these are presented salon style, to discuss these images and have a look at this, but to also honor the folks that have contributed to the canon of this collective history that we celebrate by looking at my Uncle Maurice's pictures as well. And so in order to get us started in that process tonight, I have invited two gentlemen whose work I respect a lot and who I became acquainted with trying to be the person on stage, trying to be someone who was exercising my craft and was just happy that there were folks out there with camera lenses who had an interest in capturing it, like this other gentleman here. I won't embarrass him and start going into history of the shutterbugs in the audience that I know, but I would not have videotaped archives, if you will, of some of my own performances and some of the people that I consider to be dear friends and peers if these two gentlemen had not taken it upon themselves to be present in these cultural spaces and capture performances with their camera. And so after our Q&A, you are invited to step into the multimedia, what we call the immersion space here, to see a reel that they put together of some of these moments in history that they have captured, conversations with civil rights leaders and performers and other notables in our society, and how important it is to capture it when you have the opportunity to do so. And so to tell us a little bit about that process, what has motivated you to be in that business and to continue to serve up our culture back to us in beautiful ways, please join me in welcoming Mike D and Daryl DeBress.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. I didn't expect all this. The shadows of our ancestors just, I'm humbled and then very blessed and honored to be here. So thank you for allowing us to be a part of this exhibit. I think this is the first time we've had our work featured in such a space. Like this, I feel like we made art for a second.
Oh yeah, you've definitely made art. And so we want to go back though. I know the story, but I know a lot of people who are here tonight don't, about Video Library.
Okay,
and the role that Video Library played in helping to develop a friendship and a partnership that has brought us so much of this wonderful archival footage.
People from Philly, I worked at Video Library from, I guess, the age of 15, off and on going to college and stuff, off and on for probably 20 years, and was a used tape buyer. There were two locations, one literally right directly across like a block, 40th and Locust, like a block from here. And then the one that I worked at was at Germantown and Mallory, 7157 Germantown Avenue. The pizza place is still there. It's across from McMenamin's, if people are near the liquor store. But Daryl, I never heard your side of the story, but yeah, I used to work there.
My side. Well, I would go rent films, actually, from Video Library, where Mike worked. And Mike was a resident film critic, expert. He went to film school. He was a filmmaker. So I would ask him about films and, you know. But I also wondered, you know, he always talked about he had a camera. He was a filmmaker. And I was wondering what you were filming, you know, especially in Philadelphia. The community that I came from, a lot of people didn't venture out. We didn't know anything really about making movies. So when I met a filmmaker, I said, hey, this might be something you might be interested in taking a look at. So I invited Mike down to the Black Lily at the Five Spot one day. So you want to say what happened the first time you went?
Oh, I have permission to tell this story now? I ran this, but I don't want to embarrass anybody. So yeah, Daryl, he's very laid back and lackadaisical, even more so than me. And it's like, you know, things happen for a reason, right? So like maybe about 2 weeks before, there's a big article either in the Daily News or the Weekly or one of those places about how the Jazzy Fat Nasties were making a space for local artists to perform. And they were tied in with the Roots and everything. And it was literally the place to be. And any given week, Janet Jackson and Puffy could be there. And it sounded really exciting. But I like to stay home. So he's like, I've been there, I've been filming, you should come down. I was like, oh, bet, you know, I just got a camera. I'll meet you there. What time does it start? 10 o'clock, I get there at 10, and Daryl ain't there. And I go to the door, I say, I'm here to film. Daryl sent me in there, like, who's Daryl? River said, who's Daryl? We don't know any Daryl. Go away. So I literally got sent home, and I don't know, maybe that was a good thing. I was mad at Daryl for weeks. Because it's like he set me up, but then it kind of makes you want it more. And I think, you know, once we got it straight and he showed up the next week, it was a magical night. And unfortunately, we didn't put it in this reel, but the very first night at Black Lily was actually the very first night that Jasmine Sullivan performed there. And she's the 13.
13.
She's 13, but it was her very first night. And they introduced her, and we both had cameras running, we captured, you know, she did a couple covers, and it was just magical. And it's like, wow, this person's a star. And the whole night was just energy, and nobody really was filming. Like if you had a camera, it was like on a cell phone or something. And we're talking like 2001. So you're talking like 5 pixels, you know, and most people are like filming, but they got their drinks and it's like bouncing. And I said, this needs to be captured. And over time, I think we figured out a way to build trust and through Rich Nichols and Mercedes and Tracy, we basically had carte blanche. It took a while to get access to the soundboard. There was a whole thing about getting the board audio, but that was the first step.
And so for people who are unfamiliar with the venue or the kind of lore of what Black Lily and the Five Spot meant to the community here, the Jazzies, rather than use their promotional budget that they were given from MCA, their label, to do what typical folks do, which is shoot a lot of high-priced videos and do a lot of different marketing tactics in order to build a name for yourself and sell your albums, they invested their promotional budget from the label in creating this venue and inviting either unsigned artists or up-and-coming artists to come out and perform in this open mic setting. And so people might do material that they were working on. They might be testing out brand new material that had not been recorded and released, or they might be doing their favorite cover song, or they might be looking for an opportunity to collaborate because Philadelphia was such a hotbed of production at the time. They might be looking to get on stage and show people what they could do so that one of these hot producers like Jazzy Jeff or Amir Questlove Thompson from The Roots and these other folks would be interested in taking on their project or to do a song or two on their albums and allow them to become stars. That's what Philadelphia was becoming known for. And so these gentlemen being able to show up and set up cameras and shoot these performances have access to such an archive of never before seen or heard songs, performances from these artists that now have gone on to sell millions of albums worldwide. And
well, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, that was really, and I see a lot of faces that know this already. That was like the bedrock of neo soul music was Philadelphia. The hub was the studio Larry Gold's, and eventually it led to the opportunity to make a 25-minute short documentary for WYB Philadelphia Stories called Jazzy, Fat, Nasties in Process. But we, so on Tuesday nights you had the Five Spot, and then next door to Video Library was North by Northwest, and on any given night you might see Lady Alma there. John Stevens, Eric
Before
Roberson.
He became
John Legend. I'm sorry. Okay, government names, right? Lady Alma. Who else do we film there? Jeff Bradshaw. No, I'm thinking the woman. Carol Riddick, we filmed there. Breakwater. Well, Breakwater's later. But Philly was a hot spot for talent. And I think the thing that I didn't realize, I mean, I knew coming from film school that this was need to be preserved. You know, I went to NYU and American Film Institute, and I said, there's a story here, but what I didn't realize was that just as they were developing their craft by performing night after night, we were building skills in terms of just having things to film, and within a week we could cut a performance, and it was pre-YouTube, and hand it like a DVD of a song to the artist. It was a great way to get your 10,000 hours in.
I was gonna say, and let's stay there for a second for both of you, because Mike with your film school experience and Daryl with you really having kind of a passion for this archival process, both sound and video.
Family too, big background.
Yes.
I just wanted to touch on that. excuse me. My background, actually one of my uncles was one of Art Blakey's jazz messengers. And growing up Spanky the Breast, my father would tell me stories of how a lot of the musicians were exploited. You know, they would go into the studio, they would get recorded, and nobody knew that they were being recorded, and years later, you know, an album would come out. And as a result, the family, they have no residuals, there are no royalties, there's nothing. So I always said that I'm interested in the art, but I always wanted to talk to the musicians. Like, every time I went to the basement of the Black Lily, I was saying, look, you guys got to record your own stuff. You got to, there's something called MP3s coming out. You know, Apple's going to have Apple Music. And I was telling them years ago, like, this is the way to go. But everybody wanted the record deal. So we kind of felt as though if we do this for you now, at some point, you're going to appreciate it. You know, and it kind of came back around. So as I say, now everyone is eye level. Now that most people have their material and they can control their own content, it works out.
Right, but there was a literature, and then also Craig Carpenter's not here. Yeah. We worked. I mean, if we were just talking about music stuff, Craig's probably responsible for half the things, just like because he had an eye for it, he had a love for it. He still does a lot of still photography and concert photography. So that just gave an excuse. Let's keep our relationship going. We're World Cafe Live, or if we see something that's coming up, let's try and get an interview. And I mean, this is all, the impetus of it was Real Black TV on DUTV first, and now it's on Philly Cam. Every Thursday, actually, it's on as we speak, or maybe 8:30 on Thursdays, you can catch the broadcast, but it's all on YouTube. So all these things kind of dovetailed organically as a way to film, bring people in, get practice, and then years later, it's like boxes and boxes of things and going to film festivals and, you know, one of the first people to interview, Janelle Monáe, Ava DuVernay, you'll see Chris Rock, that's a student piece, you know, so that kind of becomes the modus operandi too, which is getting people either in before they're famous or after they become legendary, you know, but and try to give you a perspective on becoming something, empowering yourself through these stories, these interviews.
Oh, you know, the kind of coming together of your interest in capturing and honoring the work of the artist also came together with the fact that you were prepared because you all had cameras. You know, I think one of the things that we want to explore in the course of these Q&As, and hopefully that people will reflect upon as you leave the exhibit, is this idea of, we have so much technology now at our fingertips. How are we using it? And so having video cameras in the early 2000s was kind of a big deal, because, you know, price point and also the kind of differentiation between point and shoot, you know, it's like point and shoot cameras versus DSLR, more of a professional grade of camera. There were a lot of people who just didn't buy them for any purpose other than trying to shoot their kids learning how to walk and that kind of thing. But you all were able to walk into a space, set up a tripod, or, you know, fight the crowd and get up close to the stage because you had, you know, high quality cameras capture this.
The technology was, leading into, yeah, I guess there was some.
The high quality camera. I had the family handy cam. It was a JVC. I still have it, you know.
Right, but they're all digital.
Right, it was digital.
Mini DV and Apple Final Cut Pro were the two technological advents that allowed me to say, let me make the investment. I mean, at the time, I was making, I still haven't gotten paychecks like this. I was in the union working at KYW. I was working at Video Library weekends, and then I was on call to work as an editor overnights at Channel 3. Around that time. So they literally, it was a switchover from analog to digital. So they literally, I barely knew I was doing analog, but I had the experience from film school. I could take the test and pass it, but literally about 6 months after I started, they said, we're switching to nonlinear. So I got paid to learn how to edit nonlinear. And then a friend of mine I was talking to, who's sort of like Daryl, just technological geek, was like, okay, you know, for about 10 grand, you could put yourself in this game. You know, you could buy a Apple G4 Mac. Mm-hmm. You know, hard drives at the time, like a terabyte. There was no such thing as a terabyte hard drive. But, you know, like a DVD burner was like, my first DVD burner was $650. And the camera, I think, was about 2 grand. So they said, you know, so I was like, I had good credit then. And I said, well, let me just take the leap. And the first year, not only was shooting that stuff, but, you know, when you're hungry for stuff, when you've been deprived, going to film festivals, watching tons of movies that you just think you can do better, you just stay up all night and make stuff. So the first 2 years I had my gear, I had 5 movies in film festivals. And, you know, Stephanie and I, we went to Denver. We both had films and stuff. So that's what the technology allowed. But now I think I don't even like going to shows to shoot, like, because everybody has their phones, and it's like, I mean, I think the first time, there was like maybe about 5 years ago, we shot a show at World Cafe, and I managed to get like five people to come out to shoot.
Tell them one of your favorite cameras now.
I shoot with the phone a lot, but like we, you know, shot like five cameras, and before I got home, like there were like 20 people had uploaded their version of the experience to YouTube. So I said, well, we're not the myth makers any longer. So I kind of shifted my energy to less concert stuff and more ethnography through what the YouTube does.
I think that some people shoot, especially today, they shoot to say, look where I am. You know, I'm in this place where you're not right now. And they take pictures. I came from North Philadelphia, around Broad and Erie. And a lot of the places that I ventured to, a lot of people in the community, they didn't want to go out to, or they just didn't know about it. So I shot to say, look where you should be. My shooting was to capture the soul and try to invite you out and say, you know you want to be here, you know you want to try this. So that's kind of, that was my philosophy behind shooting. And that's what I try to do now, is to make you want to feel what's going on in that space and want to venture out.
I also want to say that I don't think that everybody's entry point to this, Black Lily is a perfect example. The very earliest wave of people who were Black Lily regulars came because they wanted to be seen and heard, but in a context of other up-and-coming artists and being surrounded by quality talent. The next wave of folks, after Black Lily developed a reputation, came because they wanted to be seen and heard, but they wanted to be thought of immediately on a particular level of professionalism or quality. I mean, people started moving to Philadelphia in order to be part of the scene.
Right.
And so it changed the vibration in the room of why both the performers came and just onlookers. Mm-hmm. And it helped to develop a reputation here in Philadelphia that we were cliquish. And I wonder, you know, as a performer, there was a constant conversation around what it means for Philadelphia to be cliquish. And I always kind of shunned that because I'm like, these are natural friendships. It's just happened that you hang out with a really, really talented group of people. But from the lens side, as you're capturing this, did you feel as acutely the shift in people's intentions for being in a space or delivering the artistry and what the scene was developing into that you all were capturing each week?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, to piggyback on what Daryl was saying, my reason for wanting to document this stuff was because so much of our history as people of color has been in the oral tradition, and it seems like things that are written don't we're not as tuned into that, but visually and what we speak is how we remember. And having a camera, it's like, you know, I think one of the things was Ken Burns Jazz. You know, as great a film as it was, I said, well, you know, if somebody had decided to put the money up 10 years before, how many people would have actually been able to speak in their own voice about the experience of being a progenitor of jazz? So when I had an opportunity to see what was going on in Black Lily and how so many people, you know, from Jill Scott to Kindred to Jazzy's, the Roots, they're all in their prime making this stuff and getting signed to labels, Flowetry and all this stuff. I said, well, we have an opportunity to tell our own story, and let's not wait for somebody else to determine its value. And that's always the tension I have in terms of Black creativity. It's like, it seems like it doesn't matter until somebody else assigns value to it. So I really appreciate the fact that we have a chance to do this here. But I think also you see a subcultural thing. Like if you study any subculture, there's a rise and a fall. There's people, it starts off as seedlings and it grows just on the strength of love, and then eventually it gets commodified and maybe assigned a name, you know, we're voguing now, you know, or it's neo-soul now, and then people identify around it, and it's used to sell something. But, you know, eventually, I think what I started to notice, and we stopped going every single week after a point because people weren't really using it as a safe space to experiment as much as we're going to give the exact same show every week and we're going to hone our performance. It's almost like there are a few artists that like Shakinen might come in with something new, but after a while I feel like the main acts were just giving you the same set list every week, and then maybe what happened was when their records came out,
right,
they went on tour. It wasn't like the Apollo thing, which was we can make more money at the Apollo, you know, performing in a big stadium as opposed to doing 10 shows a week at the Apollo. It was more a situation with Black Lily where literally these people were touring the world with their music, and the next wave of artists weren't quite on that same level of experience. You know, you're talking about somebody like Kindred. They both had record deals 5 years before they came together as the Family Soul, and they knew their craft, and they were just, the opportunity to perform at a Black Lily was what a lot of people, even Jasmine, even though she was 13, she'd been performing, you know, she performed for Stevie Wonder, you know, 2-3 years before Black Lily even started. So once you pull all the stuff out of the ground, and the next wave of seeds have to grow as well. And I think
dovetail on that, back to your point a little bit when you said it became cliquish. I mean, churches are cliquish, and Tuesday night was like a religious thing. Mm-hmm. It was church for a lot of people, and humans naturally have groups. So capturing it, I'm like an observer. You know, you see these groups, but each group had a story. So for us, you know, we would go to one set of artists, the Jazzies, that would be one type of story. Kindred had another type of story. Jill Scott has another type of story. Jaguar definitely has another type of story. So again, to us, that was a great thing that everybody had different types of stories to tell.
And I think for the most part, it was open enough. There are a lot of situations where, and you also see it at Black Star, where people get so enthused by the experience that they may be there like one Tuesday, they're just a spectator, but then they come back two or three Tuesdays and it's open enough. They have stuff, and I've seen that like many times at Black Lily and at Black Star, somebody will come 1 year and then the next year they'll submit and they're in the festival and they're part of the loop. So I think, you know, Philly's got it like that.
But I think also the industry, I think a lot of the artists, once they got corporate deals, and this happens everywhere, and we need to be careful about our art, a lot of times artists will come in and they wouldn't perform certain songs because now they were under contract. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not going to try this out yet because we're going to put that out on the next album. You know, so everybody became Hollywood a little bit.
Yeah.
So, but also another story that we don't mention a lot are the musicians. I mean, we know the main names, but look at Adam Blackstone.
Yes.
I mean, the bass player that sat in the back, quiet, never, you know, he was like one of the quietest dudes there, who is now the music director for the Grammys, for everything you see on television today is Adam Blackstone, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of the musicians on that stage, Scott Storch, mm-hmm. you know, so many musicians that came and sat in that room every Tuesday.
And so with that in mind, your Black Lily's one example of how this energy manifested in Philadelphia, you know, something we can point to that evolved. And for folks who aren't originally from here or are recently here, Black Lily ended, you know, folks move on. And then the venue, the Five Spot that was the host of it, actually burned to the ground in early 07. And so, you know, this history lives in the footage. Because we're not able to go back into these spaces and even attempt to recreate that energy in the same space anymore. So when you look back over, we have this wonderful reel that you all can experience. Go sit down on a riser and just take in some of these interview clips and live performances that you all were able to capture. But for each of you, is there something that stands out for you that you've captured over the years that has particular significance to you personally?
Well, a lot of it is things that we haven't shown or things you can't see. Mm-hmm. No, but Dick Gregory was one of our greatest outside of the Black Lily. But just having access, I think that trust, shooting at the Lily gave us a lot of trust, a lot of artists, because we would film and people wouldn't see it up on, you know, YouTube or whatever the next week. We would hold things until the artists, it could be sometimes 10, 20 years later, and they said, oh, I feel comfortable releasing that now. Mm-hmm. So they trusted us, which gave us entree into a lot of other people's lives. So
you have a different feeling about Dick Gregory. That's some painful. It's good karma.
Mike became a meme.
It's good karma
because of his conversations with Dick Gregory.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a life-changing experience for a lot of people. I mean, we'd gone viral many times before that, but. You know, that's probably the biggest thing we've done to date. I mean, literally millions of people. And officially, if you say, I've watched our videos on YouTube, and then probably 10 times as many people have seen snippets of it. Right. You know, like even like when we were interviewing James and Toomey, he's like, oh, I recognize your voice. So I guess, you know, until something else happens, that's the claim to fame. But I would just say, like, I feel blessed just knowing I had an interest and a talent in telling stories and just believing I could make movies. It's just having a camera just gives you a license to be anywhere. And people accept it, even now more so because of the camera phones. But people, again, trust is a big thing. I always liken it back to the City of God, Brazilian film, where the guy encounters the gangsters, and then they find he's got a camera, and then he's like, oh no, come in, we want you to tell our story. So I mean, just the amount of rooms that I've had a chance to be in, we've had a chance to witness, not only witness but be up close and be the people
barbecue
that
with Bobby
to tell the story of Bobby Seals.
I mean, who would ever thought that we would be
that was WYB. I wish there were more things like WYB where you could have work funded and you could really explore things. But that was Kevin Deal. We worked with Bobby Seale for a week. The movie you'll see in there, I made about, actually, there I am on CNN right there as we speak, looking younger and thinner. But made a movie in half a day with my grandmother, uploaded it to YouTube, got into a film festival and ended up winning a prize that took us to Washington, D.C. on the day of the inauguration. And I would say that was one of the most exciting things that's ever happened for me, because we were in D.C. It was freezing. I think you were down there too. Mm-hmm. Like literally people like, and my grandmother, she's like, do you want to go? I was like, no, honey, you can go. So, and she probably would have died, you know, like she would have froze to her wheelchair.
It was 17 degrees where I was standing out on the National Mall.
But we spent the morning with the camera just talking to people, just capturing the energy of the day. And one of the things that was most touching was a homeless woman. And she just basically bared her soul. She's like, this is such a big day. The energy, I can feel it. But I wish I was with my son. You know, he knows I've been having some tough times. And if he sees this video, you know, it's like, wow, you know, this is the power of the camera. It's not about what you did on the Instagram, what you ate today or whatever. It's really telling somebody else's story and in a way that has some empathy, you know. So that's still my number one. And then we did something similar. I had my intern, Alex, you know, she, the day after 45 won, she's gone to a school that was predominantly white, and she discovered how many people voted for Trump or were happy that Trump won. And she felt a certain way. And I said, well, not everybody feels that way. So we went literally to the Martin Luther King statue on Lancaster. We started from there and we just spent the whole day with the camera phone, just talking to people. How do you feel about the day? And we made a 10-minute movie about it, and it's on, put it on YouTube, and I think it's got like 10,000 views or something. But those are more interesting things for me, as opposed to like running up on a celebrity or catching stuff like that. It's really, my core is like, you know, we should be telling our own stories.
Yes.
In that respect, how validated do you feel about the access that you've been given and the product that you've been able to create? In the clip that's playing in the multimedia room is footage of Amy Winehouse that was actually included in her documentary. So this is what I'm talking about, these moments that you're able to capture, not knowing how important it'll be to have it then, because you won't be able to get it again. But people like Spike Lee, who have now gone on record and are championing the idea that you don't have to have a film degree to make films, that there are folks who are saying be very purposeful with the way you use this technology in order to do the storytelling, be creative about the way that you fundraise in order to get projects done, and that that is the mentality that more people should have in order to really make use of all the stuff at our fingertips.
It's my feeling about film school, I think, you know, so many stories don't get told because of barrier of entry. But I think you have to know your craft and you have to study it. And, you know, I think Pete Chapman, he said it best. He's like, film school is like going to a gym. It's like all the equipment's there. You could lose weight on your own. You could get in shape on your own. But if you have a structured system and there's accountability, you'll get to your goal much faster. So my gripe about film school isn't that you don't need it or you don't need to be educated. It's just the whole educational system is a debt system. It's a way to keep, you can't work freely as an artist if you're always thinking about money. And before you even make a film, a real film, if you go to film school, you're in for at least $200,000, right? So you're not necessarily going to be thinking about, let me go out on Lancaster Avenue and talk to somebody about how they're feeling. You're going to be like, let me figure out how to be the next whatever. And I think that's when the art suffers. And if you want to take it back to Black Lily, those people are not interested in getting record deals, you know, but they were interested in expressing themselves and connecting with the culture in a way where they're putting their spin on what the 70s were about, you know. And so I think, and if you talk about race, you know, film schools are incredibly racist, and more energy is spent just trying to justify your existence within that environment, unless you're going to Howard or someplace. At NYU, you know, I felt like I was on Noah's Ark. At AFI, I felt like I was on Noah's Ark. It was impossible. Like you feel like, you know, it's hard to get money to do anything substantial, and then everything's a freaking fight to try and justify your perspective on things. So, and I was outnumbered, outgunned so many times trying to get movies done. You know, it's like I don't want anybody to have to suffer through that. But at the same time, you have to create a system where there's some level of apprenticeship. Either, and I like what's going on today because there's so much happening in television. If you just you can make something on your reel, like Anaya Wolf. You know, she's like 16. She's making films already, and what the small amount of work that she's done will get her jobs on any number of shows that are happening, but you have to put the time in, and I think it's not anti-film school, it's anti-put yourself in the debt to be an artist. You know, that's how.
I was gonna say, well, Daryl, film is not your 9-to-5.
No, yeah. Not at all. I'm corporate. No, communications company.
Yeah.
For 27 years now. But I just had to quote also Dr. Ed Robinson said, we must tell our own stories in epic proportion. So,
yeah. That's one of our goals. It's happening. I'm not, you hit a nerve. But I mean, and I'm trying to figure out how to do it. I mean, I always felt, for being groomed, I just feel like the culture in some ways has devolved so much that I don't know if there's any coming back from it, but you know, my training ground was Cosby. You see where what they're talking about him now. It's very hard to get people to really understand the importance of a Bill Cosby, and he's from Philly, and Black Lily, and you know, so artistic integrity has always been, and speaking for the culture has always been the thing for me, and you know, I want to help more people, but it's like it is a little. I think people feel like I can do bad by myself, you know, and you know, we've never really been in a position to like pay people and hey, we're making money doing this. So folks kind of come long enough for them to get some experience and put on their resume, but to have the core team and investors and just make the bigger thing. I don't know if that, and James is here taking pictures. I don't know if that James Allen produces films as well. I don't know if it's possible in Philly to do what the music industry has done for Black folks. The talent just keeps evaporating, or it's lowest common denominator. So really about let's get something done at this level and get it out.
Well, there's also a dynamic that we were talking about, I was having in some casual conversations as the doors open tonight, about the fact that when you're 22, mm-hmm. and you're in these creative spaces and your primary objective is to be seen and heard and taken seriously for your craft, it's a different consideration when you're 35 and might be married or a parent or in a different space in life about how much time and energy and focus you can dedicate to the hustle that you could when you were fresh out of college or, you know, just starting out in finding your voice and developing your skill. So, you know, there's a kind of life arc, I think, that happens to a lot of people.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't want to generalize about anybody's path. I think you can start any time you want. I mean, like, I was lucky. The first film I made, I was 13 years old. I worked in a video store. It's always been my love, and when I meet people that have that same passion, they could be 12 or they could be 40, you know, so you have to invest that time and energy. It's just, I mean, what I'm saying about Philly is just there really is no film industry here. So when you get people that do have that drive and that hunger, there's a big reluctance for them to stay here, you know, and work and say, Night Shyamalan was the person that convinced me that I don't need to go back to LA. I don't need to spend New York rent, you know, to tell stories. And I guess I've been stubborn about that. But, you know, just coming together, recognizing, and then we just showed Bring the Beat Back. I mean, the music industry, one of the things that Chuck D says is like, instead of trying to find what's unique about Philly and Philly hip hop, a lot of artists tried to migrate into what New York was doing or maybe identify with that. So I don't know if we've, I mean, there's stories everywhere. I don't know if we've captured nearly a tenth of what could be that would define Philly as a regional filmmaking scene. And I don't know if there's enough talent, like you say, that can do this full time enough for you to get a strong Philly brand. I mean, I would have thought we would have had a version of 8 Mile by now.
Well, I was going to say, you've given us the wonderful language of Dr. Ed Robinson about telling our stories in epic proportions. What does that mean for you? Do you have a passion project that's lingering out there somewhere?
Well, I just wanted to, I don't know if you hear a level of frustration in Mike's response, but I feel as though that there, I'm just looking at this room. Mm-hmm. You had to sacrifice some of your family time. You had to sacrifice some of your kids growing up. You had to sacrifice a lot to be the griot. And I think that there's a role that we have to play. And everybody in society sacrifices to play a role to help the next generation. Right. So although, you know, you might not be the filmmaker that Philadelphia deserves or whether or not they will respond the way that we need.
Oh, no. So I'm
no, happy. But what I'm saying is that we do need the griots, though. And that's how I look at it.
No,
overall.
I feel, look, don't get me wrong. I'm very happy.
I didn't mean you in particular, but okay. There are a lot of people who feel.
Well, I mean, everything is a sacrifice. Everything, there's a price for everything, you know. So I guess my frustration is, especially when I see the photography here, I know the stories, I know the struggles. We are blessed to be able to talk to people. I mean, somebody said, like, wow, you know, Gil Scott Heron. I mean, that was a great day, too. We spent the whole afternoon listening to him and absorbing his energy. A lot of right. people aren't here. And every year that goes by, there might be a piece of footage that we manage to capture of someone who's transitioned, yeah. you know, Chico Hamilton. You know, when I was at Dick Gregory's service, that homecoming was, like, epic. It was, like, 8 hours of freaking Dick Gregory. But so many people have made it so easy for us to be where we are. It's like we're all on the shoulders of that, and I feel like we owe it to our ancestors to keep these stories alive. So maybe that's the frustration, that I don't necessarily see that same responsibility valued in the culture as much today. And maybe when we talk on the radio, when you see the door finally opened and now value is being assigned to what we do naturally, there's a level of compromise that comes in. And that's where I would like to see more people just take their phone out and talk to their grandmother, take their phone out, talk to the guy on the street, use the information that we've done to help open a door of discovery, as opposed to always treating it like, hey, this is like a cool mirror. You know, this is me doing this. This is me doing that. Hey, let me do this. And trying to, I mean, the biggest, I always talk to Charles Woods. Like, I don't want to be a pundit. I don't want people to think that I certainly know stuff. I take on my gray hairs, but I don't want anybody to think that they can't do what we've
right.
done.
Right.
It's so much easier now, because that phone there, it'll shoot. If we leave that particular thing there, it'll shoot for 7 hours, unless it overheats nonstop, and it won't cost any more money than what it costs a month. Whereas a lot of weeks we can go to Black Lily just because we didn't have money for tape. Right. We never asked for anything back for anybody. We just did this on the strength, and a tape back then was what, $8, $10 a pop,
right,
for 1 hour. You know, when I was in film school, 10 minutes of film was $100 just for the film. And then to get it, and you didn't even know if it was in focus or exposed properly until you gave the lab $100 to get it back, you know. And then you'd have to get a screening room or a steam beck just to be able to project it. So I'm envious in some ways of people that want to tell stories today and the technology. But at the same time, I have a certain amount of anxiety that it's been not monetizable. And you don't get a lot of likes for it. People won't go in the direction of, let's make sure that we get this captured properly.
And so that kind of brings us to a wrapping up point, because I want to give people a chance who have not had a chance yet to see some of the images to walk through, and certainly for people to come in and see some of the footage that you have allowed us to share as a part of this exhibit, which I'm deeply, deeply grateful for. The family connection that gave me access to these photos is complicated. My Uncle Maurice was never married to my Aunt Edith, but they had a child together, and they loved each other. And so there was a relationship that he had with his camera and that he had with her that created these archives that I'm able to share on the walls of SLUT with you all. And so I want you to have an opportunity, if you've not yet had one, to walk through and to take a look at these images, to feel the passion and the love for capturing these moments that my Uncle Maurice had, and to also think about the value of a moment.